David Dubilet is an underwater photographer who's mesmerised by his subject matter and who believes to his bones, as you'll hear, the power of a photo, which can inform people better in some ways, he says, than anything else, because he believes we know so little about our oceans and seas, and we need to know so much more. He's published quite widely about life underwater, and in his 40-something years with National Geographic. David's in the Sydney studio with me. Welcome to Saturday Extra, David.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, yeah. I know you've told the story many times, but you were at school camp, I gather, very reluctantly as an 8-year-old, when the magic of taking a photograph hit you?
Oh, they sent us all to camp. If you lived in New York City in the 1950s and growing up there, you were shipped to summer camp. And this is in the Adirondack Mountains. And I had asthma. And the specialty of the camp was, of course, mountain climbing. So I ended up wheezing my way up many peaks and hating every minute. I didn't like the horses very much or archery. So they sent me down to the waterfront and they said, "Here, kid, try on this mask." And I remember distinctly a beautiful little French blue mask. And I put it on, molded it to my face, and put my head underwater. And my life changed completely.
Really?
I mean, right before me was this world with shafts of light and green algae flowing back and forth. And a giant water spider, dock spider, that the counselors thought I would be scared completely of. And I loved it. And I could move. My lungs floated. I felt wonderful. I felt it more at home underwater than I ever felt on the land.
So what about taking pictures underwater? So the water was this magic moment. But what about the business of taking pictures?
I wanted to be a photographer underwater. For some reason, this changed. And by the time I was 12, this is what I wanted to do. And the first camera was a Brownie Hawkeye. My father bought a rubber bag, an anesthesiologist bag, home from the hospital. He was a professor of surgery at NYU, New York. And we put our Brownie Hawkeye in the bag and put it together with an old diving mask. And lo and behold, here was an underwater camera. And I began to take these pictures, pictures that I knew that were going to instantly catapult me into success and becoming a National Geographic photographer at age 12. They were going to just scoop me up and and that was the end of it. The first pictures, of course, were incredibly awful and beyond abstract.
So you had big dreams.
I had huge dreams. And you know, these are dreams, reading National Geographic under the covers age 10 and then looking at the works of Lewis Marden and later on Bates Littlehales, who became my mentors there and really helped me on a way, on a path to shooting pictures in this greatest of all mediums.
And is there a particular location or aspect of marine life that just captivated you, that you became slightly obsessional about?
You know, that's a good question. And strangely enough, somehow I've become more or less a generalist. I adore the coral reefs, and yet, even though we're new to the ice, Jennifer and I, my partner Jennifer Hayes, who is a marine biologist and a photographer and a journalist, we came lately to the ice, and I adore that. I love the ice and the way the ice looks in the Antarctic Peninsula or in the Gulf of St. Lawrence more than anything else now. And yet, there's then the waters of Tasmania and the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, I know about the Barrier Reef, but what is it about the waters of Tasmania?
Oh, God, Tasmania is a secret gem. This is beneath the cliffs, very close to Hobart, in a place called Eagle Hawk Neck, where the cliffs are 300 feet, 100 meters high. They plunge very deeply. It's deep water, very close to shore, and it's full of incredible animals. Everything from the red handfish to the elephant fish that comes up and spawns in the shallow water or breeds in the shallow water. All sorts of things there. Tasmania is the outback beyond the outback for underwater.
Is
that
right?
Gorgeous.
Is that word spreading? Like, is that known, or are you sort of one of the pioneers who's found this?
Well, we did a story there in the mid-90s. And it was very popular, and people began to come little by little, more and more. And I think that it still remains a destination that's less known to other places, but it's one of the finest of all temperate water diving.
Right.
Temperate water is that diving between the warm water of the tropics and the absolute freezing water of the poles. Temperate water is beautiful, and there's Tasmania in one corner of the Pacific, and of course Vancouver and the Inside Passage and the world of British Columbia on the other corner of the Pacific.
I thought you might mention, because I think you nominated to go there for the 125th anniversary of National Geographic, is it Kimby Bay in off the northern coast of New Britain in PNG?
Kimby Bay. Kimby Bay was a place in the middle of New Britain Island and the north coast, and it kind of cradles the very corner of the Bismarck Sea, which is the left-hand wing of the Great Coral Triangle. That's unlike not the Bermuda Triangle, but the Coral Triangle. And the northern part of the Coral Triangle is the Philippines, the southern part, and the western part, of course, is the great island nation of Indonesia. It's the richest coral in the world by far, and this wing of it is very beautiful. Kimby Bay is a paradise. I was there, God, it was now 18 years ago, and I was there for 4 days, maybe 6 days. And in that space of time, I made some of the best pictures. In fact, they became two covers at National Geographic over the years. You know, 6 days, two covers, amazing. And I wanted to go back, and for the 125th, we went back.
I want to know, because I'm not a photographer, regrettably, how do you take such beautiful photographs? And we've got some on our website. They're breathtaking. They're like little vignettes, I think. That's how I would describe them, little narratives of the fish and their circumstances. But when the lighting, it's so dark, there isn't lighting after just a few metres. I'm intrigued.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right, Geraldine. You go underwater, and in the first 3 feet, red begins to change. In 10 feet, it's maroon. In 60 feet, 20 meters, it's now black. Red is black. The water, even the clearest water, absorbs light that way. So you bring down strobes, underwater electronic flashes, and what they do is they restore the spectrum of light there. And the reef blooms with color. Unexpected, unpredictable. In the blink of an eye, you don't even see it until you look at the digital capture in the old days film. And there's this unbelievable color. But that's not enough. You have to think of yourself as a photographer. And we swim around with these large cameras. They have large curved front elements to them, domes, as it were. So it's about the size of a small microwave oven. And two arms with two strobes on the ends of each arm. Sometimes we'll take 3 or 4 strobes down with us. And you can't think of yourself as a paparazzi. You can't corner the fish in a dark nightclub and give it a zets. You have to think of yourself as sort of Karsh of Ottawa with the hair light and rim light and everything else to light a fish up the way it should be. And of course, fish hate to have their pictures taken.
Do they?
Oh, they're worse than children, you know. I have about 100,000 images of fish heading south.
So they is it just an instinctive thing, the light? They loathe the...
Oh, my God. Well, here's a fish. And for the most part, much of aquatic and marine life is smaller than you are. And here you're confronting this creature and it looks at you with turret eyes. And you're this enormous thing. You're blowing bubbles. You're making a hell of a lot of noise. And you have this deadly sort of death ray bread box in front of you.
Yes, yes.
Well, and, of course... You're not going to relax.
The other thing I gather you feel is that the new generation of digital cameras offers you all sorts of possibilities that the older style did not when you go underwater?
The digital revolution for underwater photography was fabulous for us. And just to give you an example, I did a story that I went down the entire length of the Red Sea. This is 1991. And I took 10 underwater camera systems. That's the bread box and the 2 strobes and everything else, 10 of them. And if I shot every single camera on a single dive, which would have been impossible, I would have shot a total of 360 pictures. Now, no underwater photographer these days goes underwater with a card that has only 360 pictures. We have 1,000 pictures, yeah. 500 pictures. And when I did that story in the Red Sea, I never saw the pictures I made for 3 months. It was total guesswork. It was big casino photography. And now you take a picture and you have an image. You can correct the image. You can see what the mistakes you're making. You see the moment. You're not supposed to do this while you're shooting, but at times you have to check.
And you've developed something, I gather, called the split lens camera. Tell us about that, if you can.
Split lens picture is a picture where you're half in and half out of the water. And I wasn't the developer of it, but I took the technology a little bit farther, which I loved. And I loved it because of a quote from Jacques Cousteau in his book, The Silent World. That's the one I read under the covers with a flashlight when I was 10 years old. And he wrote about his first time going underwater. He had a pair of Frenet goggles. These are the goggles that aviators used. And they put putty in them so they were waterproof. This is 1930, in the mid-30s. And he looked above water and he said, I saw trolley cars. I saw light poles. I saw people on the shingle of the beach. And he put his head underwater and he said this wonderful quote, when I put my head underwater, civilization vanished with one last bow. And that was wonderful. Wonderful, because that was the kind of pictures that I wanted to take. Mm. Because you have this molecular thin curtain that divides the world of air and the world of water on this planet. And of course, the world of water beneath this molecular thin curtain, this surface, as you were, is 70% of our planet. And the difference between the two, you want to illustrate in such a way that it's more mesmerizing than simply making an underwater picture.
Yes, it's a complete challenge to grasp, actually. I can see what you're getting at, and of course that's exactly what powers you as a photographer. I mean, you've been photographing the oceans and marine life for, I think, 5 decades now. What changes have you seen?
Most of the changes I've seen are due to the intense amount of overfishing that we've done throughout the planet. Those are the key changes. For instance, when I was 12 years old, I think I saw my first coral reef in the Bahamas, and here was a world of yellow sea fans and rivers of yellow and blue striped grunts flowing between the sea fans, and all of that disappeared, gone. And then I did a story on Cuba. Jennifer and I went down to Cuba with the late Peter Benchley, and we dove in the southern islands off the coast of Cuba. They're 50 miles off the coast. And one of the islands is Cayo Largo. The other place is called the Gardens of the Queens, a lovely archipelago. Peter rolled off the side of the boat, and he wrote this: I rolled off the side of the boat into history, and this is what I saw. And everything there, because it's basically a de facto marine protected area because of the political necessities of the Castro regime, fishermen going to Cayo Largo would keep going and not stop. So it was a time capsule. Hopefully it'll stay a time capsule. And that's one of the greater changes. The other change is a little bit harder to look at. If you want to know how climate is really changing, the best place to look is the works of colleague James Balog, who has photographed the changing world of ice, the disappearance of glaciers, the warming of the sea. And that's really the smoking gun, or what I always call the smoking fish of underwater photography. Very hard to achieve. Right now we're looking at these great changes.
But hard to actually capture. Yeah.
The worst thing about it, and it may be it's an extra burden for us, for Jennifer and I, going on every single dive is a voyage, of course, of discovery, because we're still in the infancy of looking at this world. Making images underwater is less than 70 years old.
Is it?
Yeah.
David Dubilet, it's been wonderful to have you here, and thank you again for being here and for all your images.
Thank you very much.
David Dubilet, who's been a photographer with National Geographic since 1971, and I discovered after that particular interview went to air, really an absolute hero of a very surprising range of people who contacted me after that interview. He's also one of the founding fathers of the International League of Conservation Photographers. It's dedicated to further environmental and cultural conservation through ethical photography, as they describe it. Also, make sure you have a look at the Saturday Extra website. There's a video of that interview, as well as some of David's incredible photographs. It's well worth a look as perhaps you get ready to head out for a swim today. Well, that's it for another week, our first for the year. Thanks to the Saturday Extra summer production team, executive producer Jackie May, and the sound engineer Lila Schunner. More of our highlights from 7:30 next Saturday, or always online, of course, at the Radio National website. Stay with RN Summer Now. The news is next. Bye-bye for now.